So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read some poems from Waiting for Bluebeard to start with. And if I'm feeling brave enough, I'll read some newer poems as well that I haven't really read out before. So Waiting for Bluebeard is divided into two halves. And the first half is poems loosely based on childhood or kind of imagined events in childhood or metaphorical truths. And the second part of the book is a time when I lived with someone who I came to call Bluebeard, who is the Bluebeard of the fairy tales, who was a bit of a wife murderer, but nobody actually got murdered, but he just felt a bit like murdering. So the first poem I'm going to read, check time so I don't run. Right, the first poem I'm going to read is I was born in 1969, year of the moon landing, and this is that. Moon landing. Somewhere beyond weather, men are reckoning the acreage of space and playing tricks on gravity. My pregnant mother watches with the millions in their front rooms as she waits, but I will not budge. Meanwhile, the men, wrapped inside their skins, trust their lives to science and whatever wonder brought them there. The suitcase has been packed for days. All the clothes are white or lemon. A man plays hopscotch on the moon. I put these invisible stickers in my, there we go, I can see them, I can see them, not invisible. Right, so a couple of poems about what it was like to live in my parents' house, and I really shouldn't have been married, and it was all kind of uncomfortable and awkward. So this is The Family at Night. We were ragdolls after school and passed the long winter evenings like this. Father in his armchair with an unlit pipe. Mother in the kitchen pretending to eat. My sister and I with our small occupations. We saw little with our button eyes and spoke even less with our stitched up mouths. We played at playing till it was time for bed, when Mother sewed our eyelids down so we could get a good night's rest. We always woke as our human selves to find the downstairs rooms had altered too. A chair unstuffed, a table's legs all wrong. And that one time kittens gone from their basket, the mother's bone hollow meow. Sunday morning. It all comes back to the breakfast table still set in the middle of a room which has become so vast and arid you would need a camel train to cross it. Her father has turned himself altogether into wallpaper and is rolling further and further up the wall away from the sidewinders and the carpet. There is a Sunday smell of washing powder and the glimpse of her mother's back as she pegs out uniforms and the oasis of grass in a far corner. She is doing her best to spoon marmalade onto her toast, but it is molten in the desert sun. A solitary crumb falls from the table and the snake sidles over all eyes. I keep forgetting to breathe, which is a bit problematic. I've got a bit of a croak as well. I've croaked more times this evening than I've heard in some time. So this is my father, who's a very strange person, my two fathers. When my father removes his skin, he steps to one side and tidies the old skin away with a dustpan and brush. He wants nothing more than not to make a spectacle, but my mother insists he fill it with stones. The stone father is anchored to the armchair, while the other goes upstairs to his room in a sulk. The stone father holds a television control, orchestrates the night's entertainment. The other stays asleep like a bear. That's true. I think they're all true, really. Yeah. of course they're all true. So, there's lots more kind of childhoody ones there, but this is the poem that joins the two halves together, joins the childhood to the Bluebeard poems, and it's based on a sculpture by Alice Meyer. I think that's how you pronounce her name. It's called The House of Thorns, and it's a cute little plywood kind of house, but it's all thorned, you know, all on the outside, so you want to pick it up. at the same time, ouch, ouch. And also she's made a coat of nettles as well, which is exactly what it says, it's a coat of nettles. So this is a little sequence, kind of three poems. The House of Thorns. It takes no more than a word for a flame to stir in its womb, for smoke to rise and push at the walls like a trapped and injured beast. There is no chimney, no window, no gasps of air, so the fire that's grown too big for the hearth will die before it eats up the room. Here is a bed for the wolf, here is a chair burst at the seams, and here's the little pot where we'll cook and cook and cook. It's hard to imagine a path from this house when you can't imagine a door. The roof is braced against all four winds, you're swaddled inside a coat of thorns. There are stories about spring mornings, about new dew-soaked grass, the signature of your footsteps, you, the only child on earth. The house is blind to romance, makes you pin down your tongue, rocks you till you fall asleep. When the seeds are planted and the roses are grown mature enough for a harvest of thorns, and all of the effort of building a home, tattoos and scratches on your parents' hands. Now think of a house. Think of another house. A house of your own, cut from the cloth of your very own skin. The thought rises up like a singing clock, its bird constructed feathers and springs. So inside Bluebeard's house, there's a sequence of poems called The Disappearing that kind of runs all the way through. And this is, sorry, this is the first of those. The Disappearing. The tariff for crossing the threshold is a single layer of skin. She imagines a snake unzipping itself in one deft move. She imagines herself lying inside the house, a new home. She didn't imagine the scarring, nor the painstaking care required, to leave the ghost of herself on the doorstep like a cold caller. So, stop saying so. It's one of those things that people say nowadays, I think. So, again, it's like tick. What am I saying instead? Croak. Okay, croak. This poem is so Bluebeard had a dog. We had a dog, but it's called Bluebeard, but it's a beast, really. Dog. She grew to know him by his dog, gauged his humours by the slant of his ears, learned when to keep low to the ground. Dog preceded her by 15 years. Every corner of the house, every midnight walk from the pub, tattooed the map on his hide. Now dog was half blind, his teeth and claws grown dull. She nursed him with milksop all his last week. When dog died, Bluebeard sobbed, held dog's fading warmth to him, murmured for hours into dog's empty ear. Later, she found him outside, clay stuck to the soles of his boots, quarrying with pick and shovel, waist deep in dog's grave. That's true. You think that's true, that's true. And then I got into the grave and was digging with pick and shovel, and Bluebeard was up there, but it's fine. I know. Well, yeah, there could be more, but it was just too much. It was unbelievable.
Right, sir.
So, in this part of the book, right, so the I has become a she, because I'm going through this almost an out-of-body experience where I'm watching myself as another person doing these things. And this person that I became imagines that she had a child and goes around the house looking for the child. She must have been somewhere else when they cut her open, pulled the baby out and tried to zip her up like an empty bag. She must have been waiting for a bus or playing lawn tennis. She must have been Artalgis, the mermaid goddess at the boating lake. That night, cries rose from a half-closed wound and they watched her temperature soar, mapping it on a chart like the lunatic flight of a moth. She awoke as a rock in a fast-moving river. There was no child, no tiny warmth. There were voices and hands, all of them hollow. Rabbit season. Woken by the sharp burn of moonlight on her face, she moves to the window, sees searchlights unearthing the season's rabbits, and then remembers the child. The last time she'd gone out, she lost her slippers in the river, so now her bare feet carry her down the stairs, along the hallway, over the patio, and into a night cut with gunshot. She digs at the edge of the lawn with a spade first, and then with her hands, to be closer to her work. By dawn, there are little mounds of earth, but still no child. She tidies herself up in time to make Bluebeard's porridge. She watches him emerge from the field, his mossy boots soaked with dew, a string of rabbit pelts at his waist, all their open eyes. And that's the last one I'll read from that book. I did look at my watch when I started, but of course I can't remember what it said.
Five more,
thank you. Martin does all my numbers for me. okay, I should have enough time to do three of these new ones. So the collection I'm writing at the moment is called The Anatomical Venus, and it is about women and otherness. So my research has been taking me to lots of different places. We're going through it. I'm going to read some witchcrafty poems. So this has a title, which is Exodus 7:11, "Thou shalt not suffer a sorceress to live." For her neighbour's sickness was more than merely unnatural, for he sang perfectly without moving his lips. For she is intemperate in her desires and pilfers apples from the orchard. For she hitches her skirts to clamber the fence. For her womb is a wandering beast. For she is husbandless, and at candle time brazenly trades with the devil. For she spoke razors to her brother, who has looked upon her witch's clap and the odious sapling him. For the corn is foul teeth, for the horse is bedlam in its stable, for the black cow and the white cow are dead. All reasons she must be a witch. anyone that was a little bit different spoke back to people, questioned people, were probably witches, lived on their own, had cats, that kind of thing, had a little walk maybe. this poem is, it goes to the history of how women came from being the goddess fertility and representing all of this to their bodies being a curse and self-harming. So it kind of skips through time. Curse. The goddess bled into the earth and babies formed, congealed and glorious like fleshy fruit. And life went on like this with beads and lunar counting until the wild dogs hit with their beastly appetites. Hence, girls were strung up in cages when they waxed unclean, lest milk turn to vinegar or sea lay siege to fishermen. And now the goddess, thin as a whistle, hugs the hospital blanket to her waning self. Each glaring day on the ward, she makes a shiv from the moon and cuts a tidy red line into the narrow rise of her belly. It's another piece of research I did girls were strung up in cages so they wouldn't attract wild animals and stuff. See when they were bleeding and, yeah, just anyway. I'll read one more thing? Two more. Two things to me, sunshine. two more things. This poem talks to the way that women are portrayed as they're physically get older, they become less attractive, and all the images of witches are of old, largely of old women, older women, and what their bodies start doing. That's where they started from. Stripped. The kitchen is a little messy for burlesque, but let's begin. Shift the chickens, stake that bleating goat, slide the jug of wine to one side. You're home a little early from her bed. Your supper is still bubbling on the stove. My hair is restless as a nest of snakes. Your shirts have pegged out on the whirligig. Behold the dance I practice every night. The dining table is a makeshift stage. I serve myself up as a ransacked eel. That girl will learn his labours soon enough. Don't you know her eyes are painted on? The glamour of the candles will describe solely what you think is there. Same goes for that cock-a-doodle-do of hair. For the finale, I shuck off my nylon veil. My nakedness is lately bent to your sight. Here's your ring back. Those asinine mixtapes. I'll tear out a rib, return it on an oval plate. Right, I've got a couple more angry women. This is, has anyone read or aware of Malleus Maleficarum, the witch's hammer? It's a manual that that men went about the country with so they could find witches and would then know what to do with them and try them and all this kind of stuff. And it's one of the most women-hating texts I think I've ever read. Anyway, it just made me very, very angry. So it was written by in 1486 by the Reverends Cramer and Sprenger. And I think Cramer started writing it. So this is the hanged woman addresses the Reverend Heinrich Cramer. And there's a little bit from the Malleus Maleficarum which goes, to conclude, all witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which is in women insatiable. So the hanged woman addresses the Reverend Heinrich Cramer. Do you cower in your crib at night against encroaching evil tongues? I picture you skittish inside your nightgown, a swollen tempest swoop upon your roof and rattle the door you bolted thrice against the dark invisible. You said my womb knew such hunger that I might devour a man entire. Pray tell me in your clearest chapel voice what tales they told you at the breast. A pretty devil's pack that would render your creeping flesh delicious. A sough of wind stirs papers on your desk. You say women have weak memories, then you shall be perplexed that despite my ruined body on the noose, I recall its gnawing passage in your book. When the sun awakens, they will cut me down. This last one I will read. Thank you very much for listening to me. I'm glad you all remembered how to read. The last woman to be imprisoned under the British Witchcraft Act of 1735 was Victoria Helen McRae Duncan. And this is in 1944, and she was essentially a medium, and people would go to her during the war, and people would go to her when they'd lost their sons and husbands and fathers, and they wanted to talk to them again. And and she was called Hellish Nell. Hellish Nell. They plead with me to birth their dead for them. What mother could refuse a sister mother? So I allow their soldier boys to use my voice to shape their cheery valedictions. But the mothers, they want to see their angel boys, to touch their faces one last crowning time. I must get theatrical, says my spirit guide. Then comes cheesecloth, egg white, ectoplasm leaking from my breasts. The labour stands, the delivering of a shroud into the world. And their mouths agape like greedy fish. Is that him, my baby? Oh yes, they gulp it down. In quiet times, without all eyes on me, I am forced to consider what is spirit, what is nature. I am unsteady with it all. And so I make a meal of carpet tacks to weigh me to the floor. I deserve this pain for sullying the gift bestowed on me by God. Now, dim the lights if you really want to show. See the candles burning vacancy into my meat. Does my brashness disturb you? You would prefer me fey. Stand back, I might regurgitate all hell into your choking auditorium.